The History of the Old Brick Church podcast is brought to you by St. Luke's Historic Church and Museum, located in Smithfield, Virginia. As a museum and historic site, St. Luke's focuses on the development of religious freedom and the early American religious experience. This program was supported by a grant from Virginia Humanities.
And welcome back, everybody, to another podcast episode of History from the Old Brick Church. I'm your host, John Erickson, the education coordinator at St. Luke's Historic Church and Museum in beautiful Smithfield, Virginia. And we are so excited today to have as our guest today, Dr. Anna Kay of the Landmark Trust in the UK. First time I've ever been doing an interview with somebody across the pond, as we say. And Anna is a brilliant historian who has written a book called A Restless Republic that we'll be touching on today, and is the former curator of the Royal Palaces. So you're quite the celebrity for us to have on our podcast. Thank you so much for joining us.
It's such a pleasure.
So our first question for all of our guests is always, why history? And I know you come from kind of a illustrious historian background here. So, but tell us, why did history intrigue you?
Well, it didn't start with. I came to it, when I was at school and growing up, I loved literature, really, you know, reading and books and novels and so on. But in my summer holidays, I always would do jobs, you know, waitressing and washing up and, you know, just summer jobs. And I got a job working I grew up in Scotland, and I got a job working in a castle as a kind of a guide, a room steward. And it was getting to know that one place and becoming intrigued by the lives that had been lived there over the centuries that really lit the flame for me. And yeah, it's carried on burning.
Extraordinary history in Scotland. We'll touch a little bit on Scotland in this. So you are the director of the Landmark Trust. Introduce our American audience to what you do there.
Yeah, with pleasure. So the Landmark Trust is a UK charity, and we rescue historic buildings, important historic buildings, from dereliction. And but what we do is we rescue them and repair them, supported by wonderful philanthropic giving. But then we make each one available for people to rent for short stays. So you can stay in our buildings for a week or a few days, but they're all amazing places, castles and lighthouses and writers' houses and, you know, pavilions and cottages and all sorts of things, dairies. So we have 200 buildings. We have a website, thelandmarktrust.org.uk. And if any of your listeners who have plans to come across to the UK anytime, don't give your money to a hotel. Come and stay in an amazing bit of history and support a great charity.
Well, we're going to keep that in mind, because my boss and I are talking about maybe making a trip over there. So we'll keep in contact about that. So we want to talk about your book, A Restless Republic. And I've seen in some of your presentations before, you talk about this as kind of an undertold narrative about this crucially important period. Why do you think the time of the Republic is so overlooked?
Yes, it's a curious thing. I mean, because we still have a monarchy in the UK, I mean, it's a constitutional monarchy, so it's a sort of, as you know, a kind of presentationally a monarchy, although in reality, we're much more like a republic under the skin. But nonetheless, because we do still have a monarchy, it makes people forget that we had a revolution here. A revolution every bit as bloody and complicated and challenging of the status quo as that which happened in the States in the end of the 18th century. But unlike in the States, it didn't endure in the form that it took for the decade where we were very much a kind of pure kind of a republic, for lots of very interesting reasons. But although the monarchy returned, it didn't. Lots of the changes that had happened during those 10 years did endure and really became kind of fundamental in ways the book talks about. So I suppose it's because it's easy to see the 10 years when Britain and Ireland were a republic as kind of a historical dead end, but that's to really misunderstand what happened during those years. And I wanted to bring that to the fore.
It's an extraordinarily violent period. I mean, on the continent of Europe, they're fighting, you know, religious wars like the 30 Years' War, and England kind of seems to escape that for the most part, but then embroiled in this civil war. I'm curious about as the Republic is coming into being, nobody's really thought out, I suspect, what this new government's going to look like. We have a very powerful new model army, and you have the rump parliament. But it was kind of chaotic, wasn't it?
It was. And I think, you know, you put your finger on it, which is it's easy when you think about revolutionary wars to imagine that they're revolutionary wars in the same mold as came later, which essentially are social revolutions or revolutions about representation, like the French Revolution or the Russian Revolution or to an extent the American Revolution. But the revolutionary wars in Britain, which happened 100 years earlier, weren't about that. They were really wars of religion. So it was a fight about different concepts of how the church and religious worship should happen. And as you say, across Europe in this period, there's what's known as the 30 Years' War. There were the French Wars of Religion, you know, the clues in the title. There was what's called the Dutch Revolt, which was essentially a kind of Catholic Protestant war. And although the civil wars in England, had other things in the mix, at their heart they were also about different views about the proper form of religious worship. So the fact that once they concluded and there was a radical move to execute the king, the fact that they hadn't really figured out what the new establishment was going to be was really because there was kind of complications and different views about what they had been fighting for.
And everybody thinks about Oliver Cromwell, but he's off fighting pretty quickly in Ireland after the execution of Charles I. So who are the movers and shakers back home in England while he's off in this conquest of Ireland?
Yeah, you're right to say that, because, you know, in this period is off. People often forget, first of all, that there was a gap between the end of the Civil War and the restoration of the monarchy, which there was 10 years of a republic. And they also imagine that Oliver Cromwell executed Charles I and, you know, was in charge of a kind of republican regime. But that's also not the case. I mean, Oliver Cromwell was a soldier in the army that won the Civil War. He wasn't in charge of the army, and he wasn't even to be in charge of the army until a number of years into the Republic. So he has, he has come to cut a big shadow of it. But once you disaggregate it all and get to grips with what actually happened, you see that essentially, you know, during those first years of the Republic, there are a series of people, one of whom is a guy called John Bradshaw, who was the person who tried Charles I and who was the chairman of the first council of state. And so that's the kind of the executive group that took over what had been the royal powers after the execution of the king, and a group of other people around him. Some were soldiers, some were politicians, but there wasn't a kind of single, there wasn't a single kind of Lenin or Robespierre figure, you know, who was the leader. It was a group of people, but in a way, out of that, the challenges of there not being a single forceful character, it was those circumstances that led in the end to one being drawn forth, like a vacuum, you know, like air into a vacuum, which would of course be Oliver Cromwell from the mid 1650s.
So do you have a sense of, the demographics of, by 1650, say, how much of the population is this more Puritan-leaning group, and how many are more these pro-monarchists, the Cavaliers?
So we don't have exact statistics, but very broad brush. So the vast, vast majority of people in, let's talk about England in the first instance. Ireland's obviously quite different, but in England were you know, Church of England people, attenders. That's to say they were, you know, signed up to a doctrinally Protestant church, but which still had quite a lot of sort of trappings of Catholicism in terms of church interiors, vestments worn by priests and the calendar. I would say that, and then there's a very, very small number of people who are Catholics, tiny, fewer than 5%, who've sort of kind of endured from before the Reformation, 150 years before. And there are a microscopic number of people who are adherents to kind of new forms of religious worship, new what we would call nonconformists, so what would go on to become the Baptists, the Quakers, and so on. So then of that mass who are C of E, Church of England, kind of conforming members of the church, I would say, it's a guess, but I would hazard a guess that probably something like 40% of people felt that the church wasn't sufficiently reformed, and they were uncomfortable with Charles I, who before the Civil War had been introducing more of these kind of slightly Catholic-seeming things, more church ritual, more bowing to the altar, incense being used, that kind of stuff. And so a lot of people felt that wasn't right, and that was to move away from the purity of the Reformation and the kind of form of religion which had basically been followed under Elizabeth I's reign.
So even a bishop loses his life over this. Bishop Laud, right, is the one who's introducing a lot of those more Catholic kinds of reforms.
Yeah, and it wasn't the people who felt unhappy about that weren't all sort of zealots at all. I mean, absolutely, you know, dyed-in-the-wool, traditional English folk, gentry people and so on, felt that all of this, you know, the kind of dialing up of the kind of the ritual and the decoration of churches that Charles I was very keen on, and his Archbishop Laud was very keen on, was quite wrong. It's partly because this stuff was left kind of unresolved in the Reformation. You know, the Reformation that happened in Britain was, or in England was a kind of, it wasn't a Calvinist one. It didn't involve stripping everything out. It was a kind of quite an English sort of slightly middle way. Yes, we're reformed. Yes, we've done away with lots of the things which are, well, finally part of Catholicism and the way the Eucharist is celebrated and so on. But we're still going to keep some of that stuff because we quite like it. And, you know, May Day, they still did things, and on Michaelmas and Christmas and so on. Lots of stuff, which of course has no biblical basis at all, but which was part of the traditions of the church in England before the Reformation. So there was an inherent tension in this stuff being in there together. So it wasn't, to an extent, it's not surprising that it caused problems in the mid-17th century as it did.
So what would the transition into this Republican government have on an average citizen? Would they have seen much of a difference between Charles I and the Rump Parliament or the New Model Army and eventually Cromwell?
So that's, you know, it's a really good question. It's one of the things that I really wanted to look at in the book, not just the high politics, but what it would be like if you were a person, you know, an ordinary person of various different kind of sorts, living somewhere away from the centre in the countryside, as the vast majority of people did. And you know, some things, you know, obviously the, you know, there was no longer a king. I mean, that's quite a big deal in the sort of firmament of a person, but in reality, how much difference does that make to your day-to-day life? The fact that there wasn't a king, not that much. I mean, most of the structures of government, much, you know, government at this date, the state is tiny. Central government is micro, you know, really, really very small compared to the modern day. There isn't a welfare state. There hadn't historically been a standing army, you know, that there's no such thing as kind of income tax, you know, so it's a much, much smaller thing, central government. And local government is really what governs your life. The local committees that are made up of the great and the good, who determine, you know, legal cases and all this kind of stuff. So that structure doesn't change. However, what does change is it's suddenly the country becomes militarized. So there had been no standing army. Armies were just got together if you needed to go and fight a war overseas, and then they were all stood down. There was no kind of permanent military establishment until, at the end of the Civil War, the parliamentary army that won the civil war was kept in being, basically because the regime needed military backup to prevent uprisings against it. So for ordinary people, that meant there were soldiers around. Those people had to be paid. So taxes suddenly went up a lot. I mean, it's an irony that one of the causes of the civil war was people being unhappy about taxation. But actually, the levels of taxation under the Republic were far higher than they had ever been under the monarchy, because it had to keep all this stuff going. So that's a change. Central government gets bigger as a result. There's more intrusion into people's lives from outside by these military governors. But also, as we were just talking about, religion has changed. In the 1640s, actually before the abolition of the monarchy, but during the Civil War, the episcopacy is abolished. So bishops are all given the boot, and a new, much flatter church structure comes into being. And the Book of Common Prayer, which, you know, is, of course, this great institution in the Anglican Church, which is the kind of sets out what you do on every occasion, what the ritual is, what the rhythm is of church life, how marriages happen, how baptisms happen, how what you do on any different festival, is abolished. And instead, something's brought in called the Directory of Worship, which is completely spare. All that stuff is done away with, and it really comes back to a very, very much simpler church calendar that's just about things which have biblical reference points. So it really is just about Sunday as a day of you know, prayer and contemplation and so on. And all this, you know, famously Christmas is cancelled. It's one of the great sort of things that people know about this period, which in the church festival of Christmas was abolished, as were all the church festivals. And so if you were going to church in your parish, it was still the same building. All of the kind of decoration had been stripped out. So it was very bare in terms of the interior. The altar was taken away from the east end and placed sideways on in the middle of the aisle, so everyone could stand around it at the point when communion was taken. And everything became about the voice of the person who was reading the Bible and preaching and so on. So anyway, it became much more like what we now think of nonconformist churches being like. So that was a big change. On the other hand, a lot of the people who had been the part of the clergy before the Civil War stayed on and just accepted they had to change and do things very differently. So I think for a lot of parishioners, although the environment had changed, the fact that it's the same person, the familiar figure, someone you knew was from your locality who was presiding, even if it was over a different set of arrangements, would have been familiar and have been a degree of continuity.
So Cromwell is trying to root out some of these royalists in Ireland and Scotland and even back home in England. So let's talk about what it was like for some more prominent families. And one in particular, you know, that I'm going to bring up is the Lestrange family of Hunstanton Hall. And I'm going to share my screen really quick and just show. This is, what happened there? Technical malfunction. Well, that didn't work. But in any case, we have a 1630 organ from Hunstanton Hall that is prominent in our chancel of the Earl Brick Church. And the reason I even contacted you is because I heard a lecture where you were talking about this family. So tell us a little bit about the Lestrange family.
Yes, well, they're a fascinating family. And, you know, it's a wonderful thing that you have that organ. And it's I was so thrilled when I discovered this when I was digging around, because I was working on them, that I knew the organ had been sold, you know, a long time ago, but that it was obviously in such good hands in your church. Yeah, so the Lestrange family were and still are a family in Norfolk, which many people may know. You may not know that if you looked at a map of England, it's a sort of bit that bulges out on the right into the North Sea. So it's about 100 miles northwest of London, northeast of London, rather, right on the coast. It's a beautiful, beautiful, white, sandy, beached bit of coastline there. And the Lestrange family had owned the lands there, a big estate, for a long time, right back to the Norman Conquest. So they came there in, sometime shortly after 1066. And they've been farming that land. There's a wonderful house that still stands that they lived in, a medieval house. It's now divided up into kind of apartments, but the estate is still owned and farmed by the Lestrange family. The people who lived there in the early 17th century, in my period, the sort of head of the family was somebody called Hammond Lestrange and his wife Alice. And so they are kind of, they're not nobility, they're not in the House of Lords, they're not dukes or, you know, earls, but they're kind of the next lot down. They're baronets, which means they have a hereditary title. They're Sir Hammond Lestrange, and his son would then be Sir Nicholas Lestrange. I was very interested in them. I mean, partly because they're an interesting family. Hammond Lestrange backed Charles I in the Civil War, but his son-in-law backed the parliamentarians. You know, it's one of these interesting things where you get, the loyalties don't divide down, certainly don't divide down class lines. They were, you know, very sort of noble families on both sides in the Civil War, but they also don't divide, you know, even by family. But I was very interested in them because there's an amazing archive that survives for that family. I mean, it must be one of the best documented 17th century families, households anywhere in Britain. And Alice Lestrange, who was the matriarch, kept these incredible account books, all of which survive. I mean, thousands and thousands of pages detailing everything they bought, everything they, you know, every repair they did to any of their buildings, every chicken that they sold, every, you know, every set of wine glasses that they paid for in London, every book they bought, the details of their library and so on. So I was very interested in them in my work because I thought if with such a good archive, it should be possible to use them and to look at their experience to try to assess to what extent living through a revolutionary age might change or not change the way that you lived. And so so that's what I did. Also, as it happens, I live in Norfolk. I know landscape very well. I know these buildings well. So it felt to me like you would be able to get quite close to these people and through them to understand something about kind of human experience of this decade for those who weren't at the center and where the information is very good.
I was kind of surprised in some ways that an organ like that would survive the civil wars, that there wasn't any kind of retaliation against these, at least with Hammond Lestrange's connection with the monarchy.
Well, you see, the thing about the Civil War is unless your house was actually involved in fighting, and there were lots of houses that were, or was seen as being you know, potentially something that was going to be occupied by your enemy, there wasn't kind of ransacking. You know, this was not the French Revolution. This wasn't the case. There wasn't a guillotine and, you know, Whitehall decapitating the aristocracy. It wasn't about that. There wasn't a dispossession. It wasn't a class war kind of a revolution. So, and those who had fought against the regime that won, those who fought for the king, were not, you know, were not kind of brutalized or even really dispossessed. I mean, they had to pay hefty fines in order to get possession of their land. So they were financially drained, if you like, or called upon, but most people pretty pragmatic, and these were wealthy estates. And if you know, almost all of the families that had to pay these fines, and the Lestranges did, and they had to pay a lot because they also had to pay for lots of damage to King's Lynn, the local town during the siege. They had enough resources, they could borrow money, and it's a very interesting time for like development of financial kind of infrastructure, because mortgages and business of borrowing against land and so on really developed during this age, partly because it's kind of necessary to kind of, you know, to respond to this great sort of call upon estates to pay fines. But anyway, they were able to pay the fines to get their lands back, and they did. And almost every royalist family, even those who were really, really relentlessly opposed to the new regime, were able to do that. So it's surprising this period, because it, in lots of ways, it doesn't live up to what you imagine would have happened. There were moments of great violence and destruction, but they were quite isolated.
St. Luke's Historic Church and Museum shares stories from the early American religious experience and the movement towards religious freedom. St. Luke's is a 501c3 nonprofit, which relies heavily on public charitable contributions. In order to continue quality programming, like the History from the Old Brick Church podcast, your support is crucially important. Visit us at stlukesmuseum.org/donate for more information about St. Luke's and to make a donation. Thank you for your support.
Yeah, so happily at Hans Stanton Hall. There's the most wonderful collection of portraits that aren't shown in the hall now because, as I said, the building's been divided up into apartments, but many of which are on loan to the corporation of the local town and are on display in the civic buildings there. Shall I try and share my screen?
Yeah, go ahead.
Pictures here that I can show you if I can make this work. Can you see some?
Yes.
17th century looking people there.
Very good.
There's probably a way of making this. I'll just show it to me like this. Maybe. Yeah, there is. I think there's a sort of thing that's covering that. Oh, hang on. Here we go. Yeah. On current slide. Yes. So can you see there two 17th century people?
Yes.
So that's Hammond and Alice Lestrange. So they were living at Hunstanton Hall at the time your organ was made. So it would have been made either for them or for their son, who we'll see in a second. So and they were old by the time of the Civil War. They'd been married in the last year of Queen Elizabeth I's reign. If we move on, they had a whole lot of children. So can you see three people there, or have we jumped ahead?
Nope, you got the three. Yes.
Can you see three portraits?
Yes.
Yeah, lovely. So that's there. You see on the far left, Nicholas Lestrange, their son, his wife, and then on the far right, there the eldest son of the couple. On the left, a portrait slightly later. So those portraits will survive, which are wonderful, I'll just show you a couple more pictures which you might be interested in. This is a picture of the almshouses that still survive about 20 miles from Hunstanton Hall, a bit less, maybe 10 miles, which that Hammond Lestrange had to pay to rebuild after the ones were destroyed in the Civil War, which had stood there. You get quite a sense of the environment. And then going to Hunstanton Hall itself, these are some buildings which were also commissioned about the time your organ was commissioned by the same family. So you can see a absolutely charming little banqueting house there that stands in the landscape, and the gatehouse that was built by Hammond and Alice Lestrange to the hall. There's the hall itself as it is today. It looks exactly really as it did in their time, amazingly, a medieval house with later additions. And then that's just a bit of orientation for you. So the arrow is pointing to the bulgy bit of England that I mentioned that this estate stands on, in this lovely coastline, which sits along. And then I was just going to show you one other image that I thought you might be interested in. Oh yes, we were talking about churches. This is a surviving church in England that was built during the years that we're talking about, and quite near actually to Hunstanton, in a place called Guyhern. So this was completed in 1660. So we must imagine it being kind of commissioned at the end of the 1650s. So you could see, it is absolutely identifiably a church, but it's very plain. Mm-hmm. And there you can see the original pews there. And just at the end, there's a pulpit. So it's this much sparer, not decorated, not full of stained glass or ornaments or monuments or anything that was the appearance that would have been familiar to people in the 1650s after the reforms following the conflict of the Civil War. I shall stop sharing that.
Yeah, that's fascinating. Our church building that was completed in about 1685 was a result of something of a refugee of the Civil Wars, a guy named Joseph Bridger, who was a Cavalier And they would have had the more high-backed pews like a typical Anglican church in the United States, which, again, be a little more sparer than back in England with all the extraordinary stained glass and other decorative things. But we do get an increase in population during this period of the Commonwealth, largely those who were pro-monarchists. And, you know, Charles the First had dubbed us the Old Dominion because of the loyalty there. So it does touch our shores as well during that time period. But I wanted to shift a little bit to the places of some of the most extraordinarily brutal fighting, places like Drogheda in Ireland, the siege. This is, even for the time period, I think, extraordinarily brutal, where non-combatants were summarily executed and things. Tell us, why do you think it was, where you were commenting, it wasn't this big, bloody affair in England, but it was in Ireland.
Yeah, so, you know, Ireland was part of Charles I's dominions, as was Scotland. And, you know, we were talking about the Reformation there. And, you know, as I'm sure lots of your listeners know, but just to give us our coordinates, you know, whereas Protestantism had become very deep rooted and widely accepted in England, very widely accepted in Scotland, the same had not been true of Ireland, for reasons that we won't go into now, so it would take us too long. But by the time the sort of rumblings of war are coming in the early 17th century, Ireland is overwhelmingly Catholic. So the Reformation really didn't succeed, if you like, if we can put it in those terms, in Ireland, and that the it's governed from England as it had been since way back in the Middle Ages, and those who are governing it are Protestants. So we've already got sort of established pattern, which is very familiar, which is of a nation or a country that has one kind of religious character, but is governed by people in power, by those who are of a different sort of strand of Christianity in terms of the Protestant rulers of Ireland. Now, the Irish people were understandably pretty unhappy about this, and there was an uprising against the Protestant English rulers that kind of went off half cock. It was kind of exposed that it was going to happen before it happened, and there's a big crackdown. This is before the Civil War breaks out. This is back in 1640, and so a big English army is sent over to Ireland to put down this uprising, as it's seen. And because it's very expensive sending armies to do that sort of thing, the money that was gathered to pay this army was provided by a whole lot of London merchants, and they were told that if they kind of invested in this enterprise, they would be rewarded in lands that would be confiscated from the defeated Irish. So if we dial forward then a decade from that moment to when the Civil War has engulfed the whole country, Charles I has been executed, a republic has been brought about, the new republican leadership, having won the war in England, have yet to win the war in Ireland, because given that they're all strong Puritans, obviously the Irish Catholic population is not enthusiastic about the thought of this republican regime. So Oliver Cromwell is as a number two in the army is sent to pacify, it's a kind of euphemism of the word, isn't it, but to conquer essentially Ireland. And so what I suppose what I'm saying, giving you that long preamble, is that there are a couple of things at play here. One is that there is a pretty straightforward enterprise from London of getting control of Ireland, a country that does not want to be controlled, but which nonetheless was seen as people in London across all political persuasions as, you know, rightful part of the dominions of the London government. Secondly, you've got a formulation that requires land to be confiscated on a massive scale in order to fund the debt to the English state, which had been raised to fund the campaign, not by Cromwell, not by the Republicans. This is something that dates way back to before the Civil War. And thirdly, you've got religious difference. And, you know, there was a strongly held view in England in the 17th century and in Scotland too, that, you know, Protestantism was the proper way and that Catholics were, you know, adherents of an old superstitious faith that was treacherous and disapproved of by God. And, you know, they needed to be brought to heel. And so there was a an attitude in terms of the treatment of people in combat and in conflict when it came to people who were Catholics, which was quite different to the attitude when they were Protestants. So for example, Cromwell similarly has to go and reconquer Scotland, but far greater, not exclusively, there were some very bloody moments in that, but broad brush, the Scots had a much easier ride as far as, you know, how brutal the experience was than was the case for the Irish, because the Scots were, you know, hardcore Protestants and the Irish were Catholics. So I think we have to, you know, see it in that context. I think we also have to remember that you mentioned earlier the 30 Years' War, which is a big war of religion that's kind of engulfing all of Europe at this time. And the sort of level of brutality that happened in those two sieges in Ireland, which you've mentioned, happened on many occasions in Europe during the 30 Years' War. And I don't say it to excuse it, but just I think we have to kind of see it. It's not a totally isolated thing. It speaks to us of the way in which in combat, in when there's a very strong religious dimension, and we can think of other examples of this through history, where you see your enemy as not just the person you're fighting against over some kind of, you know, territory, but as a, you know, as being of a religious complexion that you find devilish, that influences how people behave. So there was, you know, as you mentioned, there was great brutality in those, particularly in those two sieges. The killing of people who'd already surrendered, the killing of people who were nothing to do with the fighting, killing of civilians. There's disputes about what the numbers were. We don't have that kind of precise data, but it was clearly shocking at the time.
Yeah, and I guess that gets exacerbated when you have some of these Puritan sensibilities about even that they're approaching the end times, the apocalypse is kind of being played out. So it's a good versus evil sort of thing in their mindset. Is that fairly accurate?
Yeah, I think there was absolutely that. I think there was a feeling that, you know, I think Cromwell had this feeling that it's what God wanted. And now, you know, that's very hard for us to identify with in a much more secular age. But I think that we have to, you know, I think you can't really understand this period without recognizing that there was just a whole different set of kind of attitudes and motivations that were driven by a very clear sense that this is what God wanted. And, you know, I mean, so we can think about this in the 21st century, and we think about, you know, on the face of it, utterly inexplicable acts by, you know, young people, suicide bombers or whatever. But, you know, people do extraordinary things when they are very convinced about the attitudes and the possibilities of afterlives. And, you know, so I just think we have to kind of, I'm not saying to say that anything, that any of the things that happened in those campaigns weren't awful, but I think my in writing the book and working on this period, I was trying to understand rather than to, you know, pass judgment.
Yeah, it does have an impact over here in what becomes the United States, I think, because all of this violence is sort of fresh in the minds, even 100 years later, as American framers of the Constitution are trying to look at what's going to be the role of religion in this new government. And they're going to go in a decidedly different direction, I think, very much influenced by certainly people like Algernon Sidney and others who were victims of this time period.
Yeah, and also, you know, this is the, you know, if we look at big historical time in terms of kind of European European culture. I mean, you know, the century that came next would be called the Enlightenment. And, you know, and that was to do with, this is to do with a changing set of attitudes, changing understanding of the world, the growth of science, the growth of political debate in a much broader sense, religion, becoming less all pervasive. So I think by the time you have the American Revolution, 120, 30 years later, it's a different era, I think. And to an extent, part of what I find so interesting about this decade that my book's about is that lots of the things that would make the difference between the mid 17th century and the late 18th century kind of germinated during these years, because things like a free press, the attitude that maybe more than one form of religious adherence could be okay, we didn't all have to do things the same way, an internationalism, as you've talked about, the Civil War and the Republic sent lots of people who were out of favor off on the high seas, or those who weren't happy with the regime as it was, it was a great period of trade and international transactions. So I think, to an extent, the fact that the atmosphere was very different come the late 18th century owes quite a lot to the kind of catalyst effect, if you like, of this very tumultuous decade.
So you have a new king with an interesting name of Charles III. Is that resurrecting an interest in this period, do you think?
Well, it'd be nice, wouldn't it? It's quite interesting, though. I would make one little observation on that, which is that it's gone by the wayside now. But some years ago, maybe some decades ago, the suggestion that when our new king succeeded to the throne, that he would take a different name, which actually has happened with the last few kings, not the queen who's just died, but her father and grandfather and so on. They took a new name as a sovereign that wasn't their Christian name they were normally known by. There was a suggestion that our new king would be another George. It is interesting, in a small way, that in the 10 or 20 years since that was being talked about, that has been put aside. And I wonder whether I think it's partly that it seems a bit archaic and why do you need to do that? But also I think probably there might have been a feeling that, being called Charles might associate you rather closely with, period of turmoil and republicanism and so on. And I think it's nice that doesn't seem to be, if that had been a consideration, that seems to have died away, as in, to me, this is a period which, isn't about whether or not you're a monarchist or a republican. It's about understanding how our history developed and how we've come to be the way we are.
So to finish up, I'm very curious about the fact that Cromwell is militarily so extraordinarily successful in this time period. He wins the war against the monarchists. He conquers Ireland and Scotland. He even wins a war against the Dutch. If this had been a king with that kind of resume, he'd be lauded as one of the great kings of English history. And yet this republic lasts just a little over a decade. How does that happen?
Well, I think being a good soldier and being a good king are two different things. There's no doubt that Cromwell was an outstanding soldier, perhaps the outstanding soldier in terms of British history. And his military successes were remarkable. And, you could say a lot about the cocktail of determination and kind of technical skill and personal charisma and so on, which led to that. But obviously, to be a brilliant soldier and to govern a complex country are two completely different things. And he, to be a good politician, to be a good compromiser, to be a good builder of consensus, all those things which are part of being of effective governing, a lot of those were not really in his range, partly because that wasn't his world, partly because he had a very, very strong personal relationship with God, and that overrode everything. So if he had reason to believe that God didn't approve of an action that he might take, then however much you know, however problematic that would be, that would overcome everything. So, you know, I think it can make us admire him in lots of ways, or respect him, but it doesn't necessarily make for being a brilliant king. And by contrast, Charles II, who, you know, was pretty short on integrity, you know, wasn't much of a soldier, but was actually a very effective king, and, you know, took the restored monarchy and, you know, had 25 years on the throne and died in his bed, you know. I wouldn't have liked to have seen him trying to win the Battle of Marston Moor, but I think he probably had qualities that made for more stable government than Cromwell. So, you know, it's just one of those great things, isn't it? It's how brilliance doesn't necessarily translate from one sphere to another.
So, what's the lasting legacy of this restless republic? What do you want your readers to take away from this time period?
So what I would say about it is, I think it's it was a constitutional failure of the Republic. You know, it didn't endure, and in 1660 the monarchy was restored. But it was only the monarchy was only restored not so much because everyone thought it was a brilliant formulation of power, but because everything else had been found to fail. But what I think is that one shouldn't let that make you dismiss this period. In fact, what that I think has rather hidden is the extent to which the things that happened during that decade would come to define the way that Britain and, to an extent, you know, European civilization, if you like, or experience would develop. So just something as simple and so important as the notion that authority lies with the representatives of the people was established as a concept and was adhered to for a period of time during this decade. Yes, in 1660, the monarchy came back, but by the end of the century, only a generation later, that's become enshrined. And the sovereignty of Parliament and the kind of beginning of the constitutional monarchy has happened. Newspapers came to the fore during this time, the national media, the time came by the end of the century. There's a free press in Britain. And the notion of religious tolerance, I mean, this is something that will be very dear to your hearts, I'm sure. This was the very first time in English history where the state conceded that people could follow different courses in terms of faith. You didn't all have to be part of a uniform single church. It was only to a degree, be Catholic, be an old Anglican, but you could be a Baptist and you could be one or two other things. So it was the first kind of the first sort of outing of that kind of cornerstone of civilized society. Now we feel of religious toleration, and that was began in this period. And there were lots of other things I could cite in my list of ways in which it changed the nation, but there's a few.
This has been absolutely fantastic. And I would love to have you back again sometime to talk about another book that you wrote on James, the Duke of Monmouth. And that's happening right at the time that our church building is being completed in 1685. And it's a very fascinating period, as you mentioned, towards the end of that decade for the Glorious Revolution and things. So hopefully we get to have you back again. And thank you so much.
I'd love that. And I'm just going to wave. So this is my book here. I'm just going to wave it. And I think you can get it through Blackwell's online. If anybody's interested in buying a copy, that's the way to get it if you're in the States. So
I have seen it on Amazon as well. Yes. Thank you so very much.
This program was supported by a grant from Virginia Humanities. Virginia Humanities connects people and ideas to explore the human experience and inspire cultural engagement. As the State Humanities Council, Virginia Humanities reaches millions in its estimated annual audience through festivals, grants, fellowships, digital initiatives, teacher institutes, radio programs, podcasts, apprenticeships, and school programs. Headquartered at the University of Virginia in Charlottesville, Virginia, Humanities works to serve Virginians in every corner of the Commonwealth. To learn more, visit virginiahumanities.org. To learn more about St. Luke's Historic Church and Museum, please visit stlukesmuseum.org.